At the Resource Innovation Group Social Capital Project, we've been working on climate adaptation communications for several years now. And really, for better or for worse, we've moved into an impacts conversation. We need to sort out how best to deal with that. That's why I'm really pleased to be speaking with Hunter Cutting today, who's the Director of Strategic Communications at Climate Nexus, a new climate media organization. And we're going to focus on talking about extreme weather and a recent guide that Climate Nexus released called Connecting the Dots. Thanks so much, Hunter. Really appreciate you coming.
No, happy to be here.
Now, this report and guide that you've released is really important timing in terms of its connection to November 18th. This Friday, the IPCC is going to release a special report on managing the risk of extreme weather events and disasters to advance climate change adaptation. So it's really great to be able to get this guidance out into the practitioner community before that event. So before we jump into some questions, I just wanted to share one line from the guide that particularly stood out to me. It's true that one cannot blame climate change for any one particular weather event, just as one cannot blame tobacco for the death of one particular smoker. However, just as smoking causes cancer, global warming affects extreme weather. So Hunter, I'm wondering if you could just start with talking about why it is so important to bring the extreme weather frame into the climate conversation right now.
Well, I think extreme weather is one of the few places where people actually personally experience climate change. A lot of the conversations we've had about the risks of climate change over many years now have all been looking far, far into the future. And it's very hard to get people to focus on risks that are distant, particularly because this is kind of an interesting little segue here, but when people think about pollution, they think about it as something that can be solved quickly because their experience has been with traditional pollution from cars and automobiles and smokestacks. And so when you put the scrubbers on the smokestacks or you put the clean cars on the road, the smog goes away pretty quickly. And so when we talk about impacts, 100 years from now, people naturally sort of think, oh, we got plenty of time to deal with that. They don't have a sense that we're dealing with a problem of lock-in. So having conversations about distance impacts or impacts in distant places is not nearly as helpful in getting people to focus and to wake up and smell the coffee as talking about impacts that are happening right now in our own backyard. And extreme weather is one of the best examples of that.
And in terms of the IPCC report, do you think it will have an impact on the public dialogue, that it will really give new legitimacy to the connection between extreme weather events and climate change?
Well, I think it's a matter of a slow drip, right? We're not going to turn the corner with this particular report, but it's yet another validation. The IPCC reports, as you know, don't produce any new science by themselves. They simply validate the existing science. And there's actually been a lot of new science in the last 2 to 3 years since the last major IPCC report came out. And this new science is particularly focused on, one, documenting the trends that are occurring in extreme weather, and secondly, fingerprinting, connecting them directly to increases in greenhouse gas emissions. We've seen that now with extreme precipitation. There's been new science out that says, in fact, the increases in extreme precipitation are tied directly to the increase in greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. We've also seen new science out that says that the increases in the hottest days, the hottest days are now hotter, is in fact directly due in part to increased greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. So, and the IPCC report, we expect it will validate that new science. We're going to find out on Friday. And I think that's helpful. The more we have science on our side, hopefully we can then move on to sort of moral arguments and as well as the practical discussions, like what are we going to do about it?
Well, and that really links directly to one of the first recommendations in your guide, Connecting the Dots, and that really is to try to link these extreme weather events that we're unfortunately seeing more often to the climate change trends. And within that, you talk about really focusing on two weather trends, frequency and severity. And I'm wondering if you could just give an example of the type of framing you would use to communicate, let's say, increase in frequency and severity of rainfall.
Yeah, so let's say that whatever region or town you're living in is just seeing a heck of a lot of very severe rain in a particular summer, you know, several inches dumped in 24 hours. And then this is, you know, unusual for your area. Maybe unusual for your area, but it's very consistent with the global trend where increasingly precipitation is shifting towards fewer but more heavier events. And so that's one way, using that trend, is to link an individual event to climate change, to point out, hey, this heavy rainstorm that we're experiencing right now is actually consistent. It's part of the global trend, which we're increasingly seeing rain coming in very heavy downpours. And we know that that global trend is linked directly to greenhouse gas emissions. So that's a way of sort of walking people through the links, connecting the dots from the immediate event to the global trend, and then from the global trend to global warming and climate change.
Well, I was reading, too, the connection between the frequency and severity arguments and really framing these events as unprecedented occurrences, that we are experiencing patterns outside of the norm.
Yeah, so that's another sort of hallmark of climate change in extreme weather, is that by having a warmer climate, there's just more energy in the system, and it's basically introducing wild cards. You know, and so you can expect to see things that have never happened before. So when we do see an unprecedented event, that is very consistent with the fact that the climate has changed in a fundamental way, and we would expect to see unprecedented events. So that's another sort of signature of climate change, and it's worth calling out when you see it happening in your own backyard.
Well, another recommendation that I really appreciated in the guide connecting the dots was just the idea that you do have to be careful in making these links, and it seems like you're really being quite specific in providing guidance that you recommend people talk about climate change affecting extreme weather, not climate change increasing extreme weather. And I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit more about that subtle difference and why it's so important to be careful with the words that you use to describe these types of impacts and trends.
Yeah, sure. So in that particular example that you give, climate change is not increasing all kinds of extreme weather. In fact, some kinds of extreme weather, like cold snaps, are decreasing. So, you know, you need to be careful and not sort of make a blanket statement, you know, climate change is increasing extreme weather, because it's decreasing some kinds of extreme weather. And so that's why sort of the best sort of generic statement is simply to say it's affecting extreme weather. And the reason we need to be so careful with our words is, as many people have experienced directly, this is such a contentious issue. And quite frankly, there's a lot of bad faith debate out there. And so if you say something that's sort of shorthand, that can be construed or distorted as being inaccurate, it will be construed and distorted as being inaccurate. So rather than give ammunition to the folks who look for things that they can distort, you know, we just got to be very careful with our language.
Well, you have a lot of good examples in the guide. One is, you know, this Category 5 hurricane is an example of the stronger hurricanes we can expect to see as global warming becomes locked in by heat-trapping gases. So very important qualifying language about those connections, which, yeah, I think that's really important advice. You know,
yeah,
another
–
oh, sorry,
well,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, hurricanes is a good example where for some kinds of extreme weather, like heat waves and extreme precipitation, we're already seeing the changes. We can't quite say that definitively about hurricanes yet. It's somewhat debate. You will find some scientists who will say we can see changes, but you'll also see legitimate arguments that we cannot see the changes. Nevertheless, there is widespread agreement that looking forward, we do expect to see changes in hurricanes. And so that's an example of where you really should know some few basics about the science to properly get the phrasing right. In the case of hurricanes, you got to look forward. You can't talk about current trends.
Well, and I think that's related to another key recommendation, which is trying to localize the weather impacts that you're talking about and really make the commitment to understanding the basics of the science for a particular region, since there will be differences there. Can you give an example of how you might talk about droughts in Texas versus sea level rise? Like, what are those subtle differences that you really need to look for at the local level?
Well, it's across the board. So that would be the first thing I would say. Is that, well, I mean, I can give a couple examples for Texas and drought or sea change, sea level rise. People, wherever they are, really should just do a quick primer. And in the guide, I give people places to go look so they can understand exactly what changes are in extreme weather for their region. But with drought in Texas, one thing we can say is that the drought is driven in part by extreme heat. The heat dries up the soils, and once the moisture in the soils is gone, the heat then, you know, sort of perpetuates the drought. And we do know that global warming is increasing global temperatures, increasing heat globally. So that's one way we can discuss it. Another way we know is, where we can talk about the Texas drought, is that we know that global warming is changing the patterns of precipitation globally, and that in what they call the subtropical belt around the planet, that belt tends to be drying out, whereas the mid-latitude belt, the belt that, for instance, has, you know, Michigan and Wisconsin, that belt around the planet tends to be getting more precipitation. Now, Texas happens to be in that subtropical belt, so it's very consistent with the global trend in drying in that subtropical belt. Now, we can't say, because we haven't fingerprinted, we don't have the analysis, that the dryness in Texas, in this particular location in the subtropical belt, is related to climate change. So, again, we got to be careful. We got to make the connection, point out the fact that Texas lies in the subtropical belt, and that we do know that, speaking globally, this belt is drying out.
And how does then the point about recognizing the role of natural variation fit into that?
Yeah, that's really important, because a big part of the changes that we see and a big part of extreme weather generally is natural variation. But the question or the issue when talking with people about extreme weather and global warming is, how do you begin or how do you open the conversation? However you open the conversation generally tends to frame it. It tends to, like, put people in that sort of state of mind, if you will. And so that's what I recommend, just straight up, point blank, that you do not begin any conversation with that famous phrase, you cannot link global warming to any one particular event. A, I would argue that that's sort of misleading at worst, but at best it's confusing, because you sort of tell people sort of implicitly there is no link, and then you then try to go on and explain how there could be a link. And that's just a recipe for failure in any sort of media conversation. Similarly with natural variation, if you begin by focusing on the role of natural variation, it's then hard to get people to sort of get the idea that, you know, there's a second factor in here. And so what I encourage people to do is start by telling people what we do know. We do know there is a link between global warming and extreme weather events such as this, whatever one you're talking about. And then if the conversation deepens and gets a little more nuanced, it's important to acknowledge the role of natural variation. But you have to make a choice. You know, so many communication practitioners, you know, will say ad nauseum, you know, you have one message to get across. That's sort of your little soundbite window opportunity, is one message. So are you going to talk about natural variation, or are you going to talk about global warming? You have to make the choice. I'm in the camp that you got to talk about global warming, obviously. If the conversation deepens and lengthens, it's natural and appropriate to also bring up other contributing factors like natural variation.
Well, and perhaps audience dependent, given that some audiences stall out on really engaging in climate issues because they don't know if it's human caused or natural. So maybe, you know, for those audience, the recognition of the question is important nonetheless. But I'm wondering now if we could switch to speaking of audiences that perhaps, you know, you need to move through a very deliberate path and further along to bring into the climate conversation. You know, it seems that one opportunity with extreme weather is that you can get people interested who might not otherwise care about climate. And you definitely touch on some points in the guide really saying, you know, don't debate the science of people. Don't debate that there's a consensus. But yet at the same time, don't be afraid to challenge explanations of climate change that aren't valid and to reframe it in a way that really is making the issue relevant to people, such as the emphasis on extreme weather. So I'm just wondering if you could give one or two examples of ways that you would challenge alternative explanations that wouldn't then put you on the defensive or have you back sort of debating the science.
Well, that's a very good question, because usually when you have to push back, you end up sort of needing to walk people through a little bit of the science. But I guess I would sort of hearken back just to the example you gave earlier in the conversation, that when sort of people challenge the notion of there being a link between extreme weather and climate change, I would you know, bring up the analogy, just like smoking causes cancer or HIV causes AIDS, climate change, you know, affects extreme weather, changes extreme weather. I would start there and then go into, you know, maybe the particular, you know, debunking, but it depends upon the context. And also, I mean, the first thing you've got to do in any sort of conversation like this is like, is this actually an honest question, or are you just sort of getting baited by a bad faith question into a debate about the science? Because if that's where that's going, well, then my first advice would be just to get out of that conversation. There's no way to win a debate about the science. But if it's an honest question, if people really do want to understand, you know, like, well, gee, my weather forecaster said this has got to do with El Nino. This has got nothing to do with climate change. I think it's legitimate to say, well, that makes sense. But El Nino just is sort of the engine. The real question is, where is the extra fuel coming from to accelerate the car? And that's where climate change comes along, because it's adding the extra fuel. So I think you can explain the science, but you don't want to debate the science, because that's just a losing proposition. And oftentimes, it's actually just you're being baited into an unuseful conversation.
Well, and I guess I'm wondering, too, if, you know, with the extreme weather frame, if it really even needs to be so clearly tied to the science. It would seem that for some segments of the public, the idea of improving your community's ability to respond to storms or reinvesting in crumbling infrastructure that can create jobs and make your community thrive, that there could be ways to bring people through this frame without it really ever having to mention or touch back on climate change and the science. So what's your opinion on sort of freeing the extreme weather frame and our need to act to respond to these intense storms from the climate science debate altogether?
No, I think that's a useful frame. And basically, you're making the argument that we should frame this in terms of adaptation or preparation, as opposed to framing it around the need to, you know, stop pollution. Because, you know, it doesn't matter whether the climate change is man-made or not. You know, it's happening, and we need to prepare for it and adapt to it. And so I think if you're trying to enter the conversation from that perspective, that's a very powerful way to go. I think it only brings us halfway, because it doesn't address the need to stop pollution. But I think it could be an important way to get us to the halfway mark, if you will. And that's part of the reason why, in fact, I like talking about extreme weather, is that it helps you engage the audiences who may not be ready to take on the question of, you know, what's causing all this and should we be burning fossil fuels, but are willing to sort of come to grips with the reality that, hey, this is the third extreme flood we've had in a row here in North Dakota. We needed to prepare. And once people sort of begin working in the preparation and adaptation sort of mindset, it becomes a lot more real and tangible, and quite frankly, the costs start becoming very apparent. And that immediately sort of then raises, you know, sort of the question, well, isn't prevention, you know, better than trying to take care of things after the fact through adaptation? So I think it's a very powerful way of getting people halfway, and considering that we can't even get them a quarter of the way, I think it's a useful way of getting people halfway, and then we'll try and figure out how we get them the rest of the way.
Yeah, still more work to do on those links between adaptation and mitigation, that's for sure.
Exactly.
Well, I really am grateful for the time today, and I'm just wondering in closing if there's anything else you want to highlight or call out from Connecting the Dots to ensure that the climate access practitioner community is aware of.
I think that I would just sort of repeat what you just discussed, this question of I think people do need to make a decision. Are they going to sort of use the preparation adaptation frame or not? Because increasingly what we're seeing is that the folks who are sort of trying to fight any action on climate change are sort of beginning to sort of like going, okay, well, yeah, it is warming, and yeah, there are changes in the weather, but they're beginning to try to instead focus on whether it's man-made or not. And I use that gender term quite explicitly because I do think the guys are mostly responsible here. So I think that's an essential question that people should be asking themselves as they set out to frame any of their conversations.
Well, that's great, and I did actually just read in EcoAmerica's new report that women tend to make the connection more between changes in the weather and climate issues, so you may be right with your man-made point there. Well, again, Hunter, thanks so much. We'll look forward to tracking your work with Climate Nexus and to chatting with you again after the IPCC report is released.
Yeah, let's talk.
Thanks so much.